how it's cut in the middle?
Well, they took the wood out of the inside to make it lighter.
Yeah, right.
So then it would float.
That's a tour guide explaining a wooden duck in the folk art exhibit at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. The exhibit space is noisy and full for a weekday afternoon as the visitors, young and old, check it out. We asked a few people on their way in, what do you think folk art is?
Oh my gosh.
I guess like non-traditional artistic patrimony of some sort. I'm not exactly sure, but I guess...
Common, ordinary people do the make the artworks instead of people who are trained.
Simple, homemade, unsophisticated, but could be very sophisticated in its own way.
Ditto.
Art from early America done by Americans.
A folk art is art done by an indigenous people, the art of the country that you're in.
I think that folk art is art that's created by people who don't necessarily call themselves artists.
I don't really know.
Well, I guess you're about to find out, too.
Yes,
right?
I guess we are. Thank you.
The question we asked those museum goers is the same question we'll be asking our guests this morning on Central Standard. What is folk art? I'm Gina Kaufman, and joining me now is Catherine Footer. She's one of the curators behind the Nelson's Folk Art Show, A Shared Legacy, Folk Art in America. It's on display through this Sunday. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Gina. Thank you.
What do you think about the answers your visitors gave when we asked them what they thought folk art was on their way in? Obviously, they hadn't seen the show yet.
I think they actually encapsulate what folk art could be. And it's in the mind of the beholder.
That's interesting.
I mean,
you're saying
I might
could be.
Yeah. I think there is, I may seem like I'm evading the question, but one of the things we discussed long and hard for this exhibition was that this was especially a personal vision of what American folk art is. That was fine. And maybe there are people who believe their traditional definitions, and then there's other definitions that are far broader.
It's so interesting because it sounds like such a simple question that would just have an easy answer. Folk art is fill in the blank. And that you as a museum curator, an expert in the field, that even you have a this is something it could be kind of answer mm-hmm. is really interesting to me. Why do you think that is?
I think because actually when you think of many categories of art, unless people actually self-identify themselves in a certain category, like there was a group of artists who came together who called themselves the Impressionists, but there are other people who call artists Impressionists. So does that make them Impressionists with a capital I or Impressionists with a lowercase I? So I think that there's sometimes categories that we place on people. And other times when they've actually, but for us, for folk art, it was not about untrained or unskilled artists. In fact, many of the artists in the exhibition are trained and skilled. They may seem to have a certain kind of naivete. The traditions are often based on European traditions that are brought to communities. So in the end, we decided to define for this exhibition that this was art based in community and tradition.
Community and tradition. With the answers that we heard from the people about to see that exhibition, is there something that they were going to see as they went into that space that do you think probably challenged some of those ideas that we heard?
Yes, I think the carousel figures, the trade figures.
Explain what those are.
So there are two carousel figures in the exhibition. One is of a rabbit, not your cute bunny rabbit.
And like the kind you would have ridden if you went to a carousel.
On a carousel, yes. And carousels were part of communities in the 19th century and the early 20th century. They were very much community entertainment. And I'm a big promoter of the carousel in Kit Carson County, where one of your other guests, Mo, and I went a number of years ago, and we rode the carousel.
You rode it?
We rode it, yes. And
that's
great.
Hands-on experience with
it
art.
But that's actually very important that it's hands-on, and that's part of the folk art is that it has this sort of immediacy and a connection to the world. There's not a lot of distance between us and the objects. I think that we have a real connection to them.
So how would you answer the question, what is folk art, if you had to give your personal definition?
I think I still would go with the traditional of based in community and tradition.
Well, we've got some more guests in the studio, and we're going to get their answers to that question, too. Mo Dickens of the Belger Art Center, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you, Gina. And I want to emphasize to the listeners that Catherine and I rode the Kit Carson County Carousel in Colorado, not the one that's in the Nelson Atkins. So people that go to Nelson should not expect to ride a carousel.
Thank you, Mo.
And that was a lot of words that start with a hard C sound. That was quite a tongue twister.
I didn't do a very good job with it. Kit Carson County.
Well, we've also got Kelly Ludwig in the studio. She's a Brookside folk art collector who wrote a book called Detour Art, and she also maintains a blog by that same name. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Gina.
Why don't I get your definitions of folk art, too, and then we'll discuss. Kelly, let's start with you.
I kind of like what the Museum of International Folk Art in Santa Fe calls it, it's art of the everyday. You know, it's, you know, it is rooted in tradition and community and culture. The kind of folk art that I tend to collect is maybe more self-taught, may not be quite as utilitarian, although there are pieces that the artist began very utilitarian and then just took their vision and just kept going.
Talk about what you mean by utilitarian. What kinds of objects would some people call folk art that fall into that category that you don't really think of that way?
Whirligigs, trade signs, children's toys, chairs, furniture, birdhouses, all of those things. A lot of the artists take and then they start really expanding upon them, where they almost start redefining what is a birdhouse, what is, you know, a children's toy or what I would call a trade sign. But you can go somewhere like Prattville, Alabama, and you see W.C. Rice's sign field, which is all these religious signs, who's kind of taken the notion of a sign and then really has imprinted his own vision on it.
So you don't think of those things as what your personal definition of folk art is?
I do, and I think that that kind of goes beyond what the more utilitarian, because it's not really, like, say, the signs isn't really telling you where, well, he is kind of telling you where to go, but it's not as traditional. It's expanded.
So, like, if it's a chair that represents what chairs were like made in this community all the time, that to you would not be folk art, but a chair that is elaborated beyond what a chair needs to be.
Right. Decorated, expanded upon, carved in some very beautiful traditional or non-traditional way or traditional.
A unique vision.
In a very unique vision.
Okay. I think I'm getting your definition. Mo, what do you say?
For definition of folk art?
Yeah.
Well, labels they're handy. They help you, like in the movies, you want to know if it's a romantic comedy or a documentary. So labels come into play, but they're not absolute. So if you say you're going to the Nelson to see some art, you might see a El Anatsui, you might see a Richard Estes, you might see a Jackson Pollock. It covers a wide range, and so does the term folk art. For me, when we did the show with Mike Murphy and Kelly Ludwig down at the Belger.
And that's a few years ago now.
This was 6 years ago, and it was huge. We had 69 artists from 40 states and took up two floors of the building. And it was a pretty wide range of artwork. And there was one of the artists that had an MFA in the show. And I had always defined folk artists as untrained artists, which somebody in your promo said the same thing. And I embedded that MFA for a reason.
So the MFA, that's Master of Fine Arts
from a local university. And as I would give people the tour, at the end of the tour, I'd say, now I'm going to tell you something. There was a person with an MFA in this tour. Who do you think had the MFA? And nobody ever guessed the artist that actually produced the world's largest collection of the world's smallest versions of the world's largest things, which was beautiful. It's a great thing. If you've never seen it, it lives in Lucas, Kansas now, as does the artist Erica Nelson.
Explain that project and why it counts to you as folk art in spite of the artist's extensive academic training.
Wow. Well, I called her yesterday to refresh my memory about her and the bus. What she did was she rode in this bus for 2 years all over America and photographed the world's largest bowling ball and the world's largest eight ball and the world's largest ketchup bottle. And then she went back to Lucas and carved these tiny little versions of all these world's largest things. And then at the end of the project, she actually carved a small version of the bus that she lived in and put it on the dashboard. So that's the world's smallest version of the world's largest collection of the world's smallest versions of the world's largest things. And I thought it was a very well thought out project and, you know, a beautiful piece. And I thought it was kind of...
And the bus is hand painted on the exterior in sort of, I don't know, like rough lettering, I would say.
And for the environmentalists out there, she now has a SUV that gets much better gas mileage. And she puts the tiny little things in the SUV to travel because she travels a lot and shows the collection. And so, you know, I had always defined folk artists as people who are not trained, and then I myself won a rocket grant this year, and I had no training, so does that make me a folk artist? And I think the answer is no. So I'm going to have to rethink my definition of folk art.
Why do you, okay, but so tell me why you think you're not a folk artist and Kelly is. Or not Kelly, excuse me, Eric and Elson.
Oh, gosh. Oh, boy. That would have been a question you could have asked me yesterday, give me time to prepare for. Holy smokes. One thing, I was collaborating with someone that did have an MFA, so it wasn't totally my project. And I came to it from a standpoint of someone who had worked in a gallery for 10 years. And I talked to Erica about this yesterday, and she said where she is now, she moved to Lucas, and she lives right next door to the Garden of Eden, which I hope everybody in Kansas City has seen. If not, you need to go.
And we'll talk a little bit about what that is later, but it's basically a sculpture labyrinth all made in concrete that has biblical stories as well as, like, populist fables.
It's a mind blower. Yesterday, Erica told me, she said, I love living beside the Garden of Eden because nothing I do is crazy by comparison. So she says she lives there because she always was attracted to artists who lived in self-made worlds. She was attracted to roadside attractions, and that's what she referenced in her artwork. And she said when she makes work now, she never thinks about how would this look in a gallery or what would a curator think about this. It's always just coming straight out of the gut and going straight into her front yard or, you know, into the buses that she travels around in.
So it's maybe art that's a lived experience.
Oh, definitely. In fact, last time my wife and I were at the Garden of Eden, we looked over towards Erica's house, and I said, oh, she's got a new sculpture in the garden. And then I realized it was Erica. She was working on something out in the yard.
It was a person. So she is her own art.
Very still.
I'm curious for all of you whether you recall your first introduction to folk art when you really began to take an interest in this stuff, and if you can even remember what excited you about what you saw. Catherine, I'll start with you.
Oh, wow. I'm trying to go back in time. I remember seeing Grandma Moses when I was a child, and there was a naivete to it that I responded to.
Describe Grandma Moses.
Grandma Moses was a woman who took up painting really later in life. I think she was in her 80s, an American artist, and really painted sort of villages and landscapes that were not, she wasn't academically trained, but she certainly had a very colorful, very approachable. And I think that's what I sort of responded to when I was little, was that kind of color, the sense of space, because it's not full of perspective. You can be in the picture and yet it's not real. There's something about, you can enter that world really easily. I think that's what I remember responding to.
Mo, what about you? Do you remember your first, like, really powerful encounter with folk art?
Oh, yeah. It's a vivid memory. I was taken to a show in Raleigh, North Carolina by Lydia Lunch. She was the lead singer for Teenage Jesus and the Jerks. And this would have been in the early 80s. It's an alliterative morning, isn't it? And so Lydia insisted we go see this show. And James Harold Jennings, who Kelly has some of his work, and Howard Finster and all the greats were in it. And then, of course, REM and Talking Heads worked with Howard Finster on album covers and videos. And there had been this guy in my hometown, QJ Stevenson, that I'd heard about for years. But, you know, sometimes it's hard to get respect in your own hometown. Mm-hmm. So after these experiences, then I went over to QJ's, which was about 5 miles from my house. And his site was gorgeous. He had built the Earth Museum, which he had filled with what he called man-made prehistoric fossils. And it was beautiful, and he was so interesting. And then when I met my wife, Carrie Esser, who teaches at the Art Institute, she was teaching at Duke at the time. And I said, you got to see this place. And so she goes out to QJ, and she just fell in love with the guy. He invited her to go canoeing with him and look for fossils, and they hit it off really well.
Mo, I'm intrigued by the fact that your entry point to this is like rock music and album covers, and that you've ended up through that interest in a yard that's been transformed into an earth museum with prehistoric man-made fossils.
Folk art covers a wide range, yes. Gina.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
And Kelly, what about you?
Well, I think that maybe my mom might have been a folk artist, or definitely she was not self-taught and had a really unique vision. But I was designing a book for the guys at Rare Visions and Roadside Revelations, and they had not shot any photographs for the, because they shoot all video. They didn't think this was ever going to become a book. And so I started driving around to capture some images just locally, started, you know, being able to go out and shoot with them as well, and just was overwhelmed by these artists that we were getting to meet and how they really were just creating things because they had to, like what Mo was saying, is it wasn't about anybody else's opinion, including their families and their neighbors. It was just, it was inside of them and they had to make it. And I was saturated with it and I became like obsessed with it and started researching it and writing it and collecting it. My house is way too full and I've gotten rid of stuff and it's still way too full. It's just, there's just a great energy.
Well, that
energy.
Kind of makes you a folk artist in a way, because a recurring theme I have found is that people have an abundance of stuff that they, instead of discarding, continue to find new uses and adaptations for.
Yeah, that's much to the chagrin of my neighbors too, probably. Yeah, I probably am. I found that a lot of the artists, when they were going through a difficult time in their life, be it an emotional experience like a death in the family or a physical thing, would start, you know, turning to art to kind of as an expression and an outlet for what they were going through to kind of not escape but process it.
And is that why the stuff around them just became material?
They became material. You know, they had leftover house paint. They had some lumber that was there. Mo's Tolliver, you can kind of tell what he was working on at the time, you know, professionally. He was a house painter, because all of a sudden you'll see these paintings where everything's in like this kind of teal green. It was a teal green period because obviously the house he was painting was teal green at the time. And then there was like a lot of paintings in browns because that was available. And scrap, and he used to do is the hanger for the artwork was like a beer tab that he would nail onto the back of it. So it was a lot of just this found art, found objects.
Mo wants to jump in.
Yeah. Well, also, a lot of these guys that Kelly and Mike Murphy and Randy Mason documented over the years, they went to their houses, mm-hmm. and a lot of the artwork was made for the outside of the house or for the front yard or the backyard or the fields. And so it was very accessible to the public. And sometimes they worked out there, you know, in the open. And when we brought the show into the Belger 6 years ago and put it inside a museum, it looked gorgeous. You know, we lit it well, and it was a gigantic show. And the very first visitor that morning was from Lucas. And he said, I never thought I'd see a show like this in the big city.
What did that mean to you? I mean, what does he mean by that?
I think I think he felt like those guys were validated, that mm-hmm. a place mm-hmm. like the Belger Arts Center would respect these artists and put their work inside the museum walls.
How does respect... It can seem sometimes like a fascination with this kind of stuff has like sometimes a little bit of a gawking or making a spectacle of something kind of feel. And I know that that's not what anyone here is doing, but how do you make sure that you're viewing it in a respectful way and not in a look at this crazy stuff kind of way?
Hmm. I think more exposure. I mean, I would say... One of the things that we've done also at the museum is to show the collection of American folk art that actually started with the founding of the museum. And so there's another related to a shared legacy. And there was respect for American folk art in the teens, the 20s, the 30s. A lot mm-hmm. of American modernists collected American folk art, especially those who were in New England, but also in New York. They saw something there. And I would also say it's the same sort of parallel as to what artists were looking at in African art. They were looking at art of other types as inspiration. And I don't think that they were looking at it because it was naive, but because it had something intrinsic to it that was very valuable. So I think that respect has actually been there for a really long time, and that it's not just a quirky thing.
This idea of folk art in collections, either personal collections or in museums, is interesting to me because we've been talking about that these are that this is art that's kind of lived, that's part of daily life. Do you ever struggle with that, Kelly? Do you struggle with that as a collector?
That it's lived or daily
life?
Or that life?
Something has been removed from its context to become part of that collection?
Sometimes I do. It's a really fine line. Like, definitely with folk art environments, a lot of times they can't be saved because they are wooden, or the person who has created is deceased, and maybe the town didn't care for the arts, and so it gets dismantled. I think of Jesse Howard that was in Fulton, Missouri, who did these incredible signs that the Art Institute has a great collection of. And so at that time, I don't think it's right to go and take something out of an environment that's still like a living organic place. Like, I would never dream of taking something from like the Garden of Eden, even though Dinsmore is not there. It's well preserved. But places that have like fallen into disrepair and they were vanishing, I like the notion that like the Kohler Foundation goes in and will, if it can't be like restored, they will take it into their collection and for other people to come and get to see it and experience it.
And Kohler restored Garden of Eden.
They did.
Right there on the site.
Absolutely. They've gone all around the country, and usually they deal with mostly things that are in concrete, and because it's a little bit easier to save those environments. And they've gone all over the country, and they will buy a property, restore it, and then deed it back to the community for like a dollar. So,
but Catherine, for you, is folk art still, I mean, for lack of a better word, folksy when it's in a major museum?
I think it still retains that, whatever those qualities of folk that we've been talking about, mm-hmm. I think it still retains it.
We're going to have to come back to this after the break. If you've had memorable encounters with folk art or folk artists, call us up and share those stories, especially if you know about artists or art environments in Kansas or Missouri. 816-235-2888. We'll get to those calls and more when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to Central Standard. Today, we're trying to answer a simple yet impossible question. What is folk art? Call 816-235-2888 with stories about your own encounters with folk art and possibly, if you are feeling brave, with a stab at a definition at that term. Later in the show, we'll hear what our listeners have to say about the meaning of the Confederate flag. Stay tuned for that later. Our guests for now are Mo Dickens of the Belger Art Center, folk art collector Kelly Ludwig, and Nelson Atkins curator Catherine Footer. Guys, there are some language traps we can encounter here, right? I mean, words that some people mean as compliments and others find patently offensive. What are some of these terms that kind of are often seen as subcategories of folk art?
Outsider art, yeah. Visionary art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Primitive art.
Primitive, yeah. Naive.
Right. Why, first of all, why is there that temptation to use these terms, and what are sort of the problems with that?
I would say that the temptation is that we want to categorize things. We want to have a definition so we can use it to describe. The problem is it doesn't really get doesn't define it. When you say outsider, that means they're not really artists, that they're outside of the circle. So that's not true. Naive, that can be kind of seen as offensive to the artist. So I think that it's.
And it's almost defining people by what they're not a part of.
Exactly.
Right.
When I was talking to Erica Nelson yesterday, she mentioned that she was worried that sometimes people look at folk art and think, is this really art or why is this art? Mm-hmm. And she was pleasantly surprised when I told her that happens with every show we do at the Belger. I probably got it the most with a Terry Winters show, and he's one of the giants in American art. And day after day, people said, why is this art?
Explain what he did, what was on display, and why people were responding that way.
There are actually prints of submolecular level life forms. So they look abstract when you blow them up. And people kept looking at it going, why is this art? And I said, you know what? What you're really asking me is why you don't like it. And I can't explain to you why you don't like it. It's art because it's made by an artist. If you don't like it, that's fine. That's why we have so many different kinds of art.
Well, or Christo. people have asked, why is that art?
And he's the artist.
He does land installations. He works with communities. I mean, he does interventions into the landscape.
He wrapped the sidewalks
He wrapped the sidewalks in Lewis Park, right.
Well, ironically, one of the self-taught artists I visited in Wyoming actually designed the anchors for Cristo's wrapped walkways, because Cristo would come out to Wyoming because it was so windy. And so Mel Gould, who has a place called Berryville.
Wait a minute. Why did the wind help Cristo?
Because he wanted to make sure that, like, with the wrapped walkways, with some of his, like, his running fence, that it wouldn't all of a sudden
blow away
down the landscape.
Yeah, one of the umbrellas did blow away in that project.
So right. If it stays put in Wyoming,
so it stays put in Wyoming because the winds are strong. And so he's a self-taught artist/engineer and actually designed the anchors for him. So Cristo would come and visit the self-taught artist's home and work on art. They would kind of collaborate on art together.
So maybe these distinctions are not as cut and dry as we think. But I spoke with Leslie Umbarger at the Smithsonian about this well-known grassroots art environment in Lucas, Kansas. We've referred to it a few times, the Garden of Eden. Concrete sculpture labyrinth. It's a mishmash of Bible stories and populist fables, all built by a Civil War veteran. I asked Leslie whether she thought it was important to attach a more specific label than artist to the guy who made this stuff. And here's what she said.
I'm not exactly sure if the classification itself matters. I do think that language matters. I don't ever call artists outsiders. I think ultimately it's a derogatory term. And I feel similarly about terms like primitive. I think that anything that applies a label of marginalization to the artist just really isn't particularly instructive about what the project is and what's meaningful about it. When you talk about the artist for what he is and how he learned and how he kind of articulated a personal vision, I think that it's easier to take that seriously as a valid form of artistic expression and not kind of capitalize on this aspect of eccentricity or oddity, because ultimately these are very fresh and brilliant works of art, and it is their difference and their kind of original vision that makes them great works of art.
So I think that's an interesting idea to start with the specifics of the individuals and their individual projects rather than with labels. So let's start that project with one of our callers. We've got Matt from Baldwin City calling us at 816-235-2888. Hi, Matt.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning to you, too.
This is a wonderful discussion. That was a really interesting clip you just played. The term that I have heard applied to these things is visionary environments. Mm-hmm. And years ago, I lived in Vineland, Kansas, where the Kansas Grassroots Art Association had a museum of items that they, collected from around Kansas and preserved. And I really came to understand and respect the nature of what people were doing with stuff like, cement bags of cement and broken glass. And I've tried to sort of imitate some of that stuff in my own yard. But
these other artists have given you permission.
Yeah. You go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
We'll come visit.
But I've been to some different environments, like Dr. Evermore's Evertron up near Baraboo, Wisconsin, which I understand has parts of it, I think, have been preserved maybe by the Kohler Foundation. And
they are the same people who do, like, the sinks.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Just in case you're wondering.
Yeah,
go on.
Very forward-thinking company, I think. But, I had a kind of an interesting experience one time when going into a yard that was actually in the Johnson County, and it had been decorated with these shreds of cloth on ropes. And I'm not sure why, but I kind of poked my head up into this yard to kind of see what was going on, and came away from the experience, rather than finding sort of a quirky, interesting, fun individual, I kind of backed away without making eye contact, because Yeah, some of the sentiments expressed on some of the bumper stickers on the car were kind of not exactly in line with the interests of humanity, and I was kind of made me kind of wonder: are some of the visionary folk artists themselves maybe a little difficult to get along with? You know, would S.P. Dinsmore have exactly been the most effervescent, fun guy to hang out with? I guess is what I wonder. You know, even though his work was brilliant, you know. Was he kind of maybe grinding an axe about something? And
so just quickly, S.P. Dinsmore is the Civil War veteran. He was actually a nurse
right,
in the Civil War
right.
who built the Garden of Eden.
Who built the Garden of Eden.
You know, and I visited there recently and was actually told that many people considered him the funniest man they had ever met. I don't know if that's true. I didn't meet him. But what do you think about this, Kelly?
Well, I've met a number of these artists, and there's a bit of, like, showmanship that they have. They really want people to come up and talk to them. And I really have never really run into anybody that was that difficult to talk to. And in fact, it was difficult to get away. The conversations mm-hmm. they wanted to share yeah. with you, and you're on the front porch and like you thought you were going to be there for an hour or two, and it's like 4 hours have passed and you're having these great conversations. So I've really found that the majority of the people I've met are incredibly personable.
Well, that brings up the question, if you see someone with a yard that's got some sort of deliberate activity going on mm-hmm. in it and maybe some kind of vision or personal obsession, I think some people might fear stopping because maybe they think, does that person know this is unusual? And I think I'm hearing from you, stop.
Stop.
Go
yeah.
and
stop.
Ask.
I
would agree.
Absolutely.
But if they do have those disturbing bumper stickers, then leave.
Yeah. If you yes. pick up on the cues. I mean, I find that if treat people with the respect. I mean, go up there, be respectful. Don't just walk through somebody's yard that you haven't talked to. I always try and find the owner first and ask them if it's okay if I take photographs. And they usually want to walk around and they'll tell me stories and it's an incredible experience. It's so great.
And the idea of those bumper stickers, I mean, I think that maybe Matt's feeling like there could have been some relationship between those and the mm-hmm. art, but I mm-hmm. guess anyone could have bumper stickers that might offend you.
Even
yes.
a fine artist could,
yes.
could be irascible.
Let's talk. Oh, Catherine.
I just wanted to say one thing, which I think is important, which is that there's folk art everywhere. I mean, there's folk art all over the world. So I just want to throw that into the mix here, that I've met Caribbean folk artists. Mm-hmm. So it's all, they're all different cultures have this, if we want to call it a category of art, it exists everywhere.
The creative spirit is in every country
that's
in the world.
That's right.
Are there distinctions? I mean, do the traditions differ from country to country, or do you see some universality in like the kinds of preoccupations, the kinds of impulses?
I see definite similarities. I was looking at the, excuse me if I pronounce wrong, is it? Frochter
yes.
art. It kind of reminded me of Martin Ramirez's
mm-hmm,
artwork
absolutely.
And the pattern and the color. And Martin Ramirez was a gentleman from Mexico who had then been institutionalized in California. And, you know, his work had, you know, was a treasure trove and is now on U.S. postage
That's
stamps.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But mm-hmm. I was really amazed yesterday re-looking at everything of how similar his line and pattern was.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
And I think even sort of creating new worlds. I mean, I think all artists create new worlds. And so that impulse cross cultures.
Well, one recurring theme that we found when Kelly and Mike brought their show down to the Belger was there was a lot of religious work, especially devils. We had so many devils. We had about 40 devils. We put them in a little room by themselves and called it hell. And one of my favorite moments was these two elderly women were walking through the gallery. And I said, hey, have you guys been to hell yet? And they went, yeah, we're going back.
Interesting.
It was an inviting hell.
It was fun.
Well, in this interest of telling stories about the artists and their projects, I wonder, Kelly, if you can tell us the story of missionary Mary Proctor. On your blog, I found her story really compelling.
Yes. Missionary Mary lives down in Florida, and she had kind of a odds and ends, you know, junk store, if you will. And she was going through a lot of health issues and then became more depressed after she lost like her grandmother, aunt, and uncle in a really bad house fire. So as she was grieving, God spoke to her and told her that the door was the way. And so she began to paint on this old door that was lying out in the front yard. Well, one thing led to another, and she started feeling better as she started painting all of these doors. And now her doors can be found at the American Visionary Arts Museum in Baltimore. But that helped lead her out of her depression. She's gone on to painting cabinets and walls, and she has this whole yard in Florida of different doors. She has like all the presidents now. She's expanded it beyond a vision of working through grief, and that became her solstice, and she's doing great.
And Mo, can you tell us, we talked a little bit about QJ Stevenson earlier, but I wonder if you can tell more of his story beyond your encounter with him. What is his story?
Well, he drove road grading equipment in Gettysburg, North Carolina. So he was always tearing up the earth, and he would find things as he was working, and he would collect them, and he got a pretty big collection of fossils and old rocks. And so he actually has stuff that he donated to the Museum of Natural History, but he also has artwork that's in the Smithsonian American Art Museum, or the Renwick. So he used the things that he found in his everyday job to make his artwork, and he would make birds out of sawdust and glue, and he would get kids in the area to help him. And he was, and like Kelly said, he was a guy that loved to talk. So when you would stop, you better plan on staying there for a couple of hours, and he would show you all around and tell you how he made the work. And but he passed away right before we did the show, and I was really happy when Mike and Kelly brought some of QJ's work in too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and yeah, he's obviously an artist who has meant a lot to you. How much? I mean, folk art, would you say that there's something maybe especially personal about it?
Well, actually, there's two tables that are in A Shared Legacy by John Scholl, who is from Germania, Pennsylvania. And he didn't take up making what are now called celebrations until he was 80. He was a carpenter, and so you see a lot of the architectural elements in his work. But he made them, he showed them to people, but he kept them for himself. And there are some wonderful photographs of his parlor after he died, of his casket surrounded by the celebrations. And they've got this architectural, they have a lacework, they have this just absolutely celebratory vision of what creation can be.
There's a quote that I've read that I think is interesting, maybe in this context. It's elaboration beyond necessity is art. And if you think about things that people do just on impulse in their daily lives, like making, I don't know, ordering the things in their pantry in a beautiful way that isn't necessary by putting them in like matching Tupperware. I mean, is there just a human impulse that this gets at, this idea of elaboration beyond necessity being art?
I think so. I think that there is, we have a need since we were in caves to embellish and to elaborate our environments. And whether it's taking pigment or whether it is transforming our world.
We're out of time for this folk art conversation. Keep your ears peeled for a documentary about a man who's dedicated his career to preserving the Garden of Eden sculpture environment in Lucas, Kansas. We'll be airing that later this summer. Kelly Ludwig, Mo Dickens, Catherine Footer, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so
Thank
much,
you.
Gina.
Thank you, Gina.